It must have been between classes because the only sound was their feet on the linoleum. Wilde flashed back to his own years in these hallways. He still knew his way, of course. Do you ever forget? When they passed the gymnasium, Ava gestured to the portraits on the wall. I get to see your face every day. There were probably 50 faces under the listing Sweetwater Sports Hall of Fame. Wilde had been inducted under track and field. He didn't attend the ceremony, not his scene. During his senior year, Wilde had set almost every running record in the school, hurdles, sprints, miles. The school's football coach tried to convince him to go for tailback, but Wilde didn't like team sports, with their camaraderie and rah-rah high fives. He didn't like the football team in particular, too tribal and clan-like. You look angry in the picture, Ava said. I was aiming for macho. She studied it a second. I'd say you didn't hit that mark.
I rarely do.
His eyes scanned down the plaques searching for Rolla Nacer. It didn't take long. Rolla's beaming smile, no attempt at macho here, hit him like a sunburst. That was how Rolla Nacer was, beaming, loquacious, earnest, enthusiastic, even at home. Pretty much the opposite of Wilde. Maybe that was a forced facade, her way of compensating for her upbringing, but if so, Wilde rarely saw her break character. Soccer captain, Ava said, following his eyes and reading Rolla's plaque. Wow, she was an All-American?
Rolla was the best soccer player the school ever had.
Was she a close friend?
Sister, Wilde said. Then, foster sister.
Ava led him into a classroom cum art studio. There were splashes of color everywhere. Wilde took it all in. The room was comforting, what with the creations of the uber-amateurish, blended in with the super-gifted, the half-baked sculptures, with works that could find a place in a museum. There was just life here. Lots of life. So I checked already, Ava began. Her tone was matter-of-fact. Wilde waited. Naomi has been out since last Thursday, Ava said. The absences are unexcused. The school has sent out warnings by email.
I heard it was bad when she got back from the last disappearance.
Heard from whom?
Her father, he said. No reason to bring Matthew in.
Wilde quickly updated her on the rest. Bernard Pine reaching out to him, Naomi's bedroom, the missing clothes and backpack. Yeah, it was bad, she said when he finished, as expected.
How did Naomi react?
To the bullying?
Yeah.
Naomi, I don't know. Maybe she became withdrawn? I tried to get her to open up, but she didn't share much.
Was there anyone else she might have talked to?
Not that I know of. Ava tilted her head. She told me you were the one who found her. She said you two talked in her basement.
Yes.
She liked you, Wilde.
I liked her, too.
Did she tell you why she went along with that awful game?
She hoped that it would be a reset, Wilde said.
A reset?
A way to start again with her classmates. A do-over. She thought that maybe if she did it, really made a splash, everyone would look at her differently.
Ava shook her head. I get it, but...
Wilde said nothing.
I wish these kids could understand how short high school is, she said.
They can't.
I know. My grandfather up in Maine turned 92 recently. I asked him what that was like, reaching that age. He said, it's a finger snap. He said, one day I turned 18, I joined the army, I headed south to basic training, and now I'm here, that fast. That's what he said. Like he got onto a bus with his duffel bag in 1948, and he got off now.
Sounds like a cool guy, Wilde said.
He is. I'm not sure why I told you that, except that if it's hard for us, two adults, to believe that our lives are going to whiz by that fast. It's impossible to convince a bullied 16-year-old girl that the world isn't this stupid high school.
Wilde nodded. So do you have any thoughts on where Naomi is?
I think we both agree she probably ran away.
Probably.
Ava asked, did you try her mother?
Well, I thought you said...
Yeah, I know, but that was before.
what Naomi said to you about starting over, she said something like that to me, too. But after what happened with that challenge game, she knew that it couldn't happen here, in this town. The fresh start meant a fresh place.
So you think she could be with her mom?
Naomi told me her mother was going on a trip. I didn't really think about it at the time, but maybe there was longing in her voice.
Do you know where the mother was going?
Just overseas.
Okay, I'll reach out.
Ava looked at her watch.
Wild caught the hint. You probably have a class, he said.
Yeah.
Then, about those texts I sent you the other night. Wild knew the ones she meant, of course. Come over tonight. I'll leave the door unlocked, and then... I miss you, Wild.
Don't worry about it. I wouldn't want anything more than we had. I had a lonely moment.
I get them, too.
You do?
He saw no reason to repeat himself.
It was odd, she said, what we had. Now isn't the time, but it was nice, Wild said.
Really nice.
But it couldn't last, could it?
She didn't ask it with regret or anything like that. Wild didn't respond.
It was one of those vibrant creatures that only survive a short time, a whole life cycle packed into a few days.
He thought that was well put.
Yeah, pretty much.
They both stood. Neither was sure what to do. Ava stepped toward him and kissed his cheek. He looked in her eyes and almost told her that he was available. Almost. But he didn't.
Changed the subject. Do you know the Maynard kid?
She blinked, took a step back.
Crash? My reputation.
Which is?
Crappy.
He used to torment Naomi, though maybe there was something more.
More? He doth protest too much, methinks, Ava said in her best Shakespearean accent.
Like he had a crush on her?
I wouldn't say that. He's dating Sutton Holmes, but I think Naomi fascinates Crash in ways that he probably couldn't quite articulate himself.
Is Crash Maynard in school today?
Probably. Why? What time does school let out?
Chapter 18. Hester donned her swim cap and did laps for 45 minutes in the indoor pool on the lower level of her office high-rise. Swimming laps, freestyle down the lane, breaststroke back, had been her major exercise activity for 2 decades now. Before that, she hadn't really liked the pool. Changing out of a wetsuit is a pain. You smell like chlorine. It does awful things to your hair. It is numbingly boring. But it was that last point, numbing boredom, that eventually sold Hester on it. Moments of pure alone, of pure silence, of, yes, pure boredom. Rote strokes you'll repeat hundreds, if not thousands of times this very week, ended up being what others considered zen. With her body encased in water and chemicals, Hester rehearsed summations, testimony, and cross-examinations. Today, though, alone in that pool, her body gently slicing through the water, she didn't think about work. She thought about Orin. She thought about tonight.
It's just a dinner, she reminded herself. He'd asked her out. It isn't a date, just a meal with an old friend.
Wrong. A man doesn't drive to your place of work and ask you to share a meal as 2 old friends. This was not a drill. This was a date. The real McCoy.
Hester showered, blew out her hair, got dressed in her best power suit. When she got off the elevator, Sarah McClinn, her assistant, handed her a bunch of messages that needed her attention.
Hester grabbed them, headed into her corner office, and closed the door. She sat at her desk, took a deep breath, and brought up the web browser.
"Don't, Hester," she said out loud.
But since when did Hester Krimstein take advice from anyone, especially from Hester Krimstein? In the search field, Hester typed in Cheryl Carmichael.
Yep, Orin's ex.
Half of Hester floated up and out of her body and tisk-tisked disapprovingly. The other half, the half still in the chair, frowned at the floating half and countered, "Yeah, right, like you're too good for this."
Hester hit the return button and let the screen load. The top searches were for a Cheryl Carmichael who worked as a professor at CUNY. Uh-oh, no. That was definitely the wrong Cheryl Carmichael. Hester scanned down the page. She wasn't sure what she'd find online about a divorced woman in her mid to late 60s. But when she found the right one, Cheryl Carmichael living in Vero Beach, Florida, what Hester uncovered was far worse than she'd imagined. My God. Cheryl Carmichael was all over social media. Her Instagram account had more than 800,000 followers. Her vertical Instagram bio, or whatever you called it, read, "Public figure, fitness model, influencer, and free spirit. I love life. Hashtag over 60 and fabulous." Gag me, Hester thought. Under the bio was an email address to write for inquiries. Inquiries? What kind of inquiries? Hester's mind spiraled down a prurient hole until she realized that by inquiries she meant paid endorsements. Yes, for real. Companies paid Cheryl to pose with their products. Looking at photos on display made Hester's stomach knot. Cheryl, who used to have flowing locks down to the middle of her back, Hester remembered her at the Little League field in tight shorts and a tighter top, the dads pretending not to stare, now sported that mod, short, spiky hair. Her physique, which was on display in many risque pictures with hashtags reading hashtag bikini babe, hashtag fit goals, hashtag squats, hashtag love yourself, hashtag beach bum, was all that and more. Ugh. Cheryl Carmichael was still a knockout. Hester's mobile rang. She checked the number and saw it was from Wild. "Articulate," she said. "What are you doing?" "Making myself feel immensely inadequate." "Pardon? Never mind. What's up?" "Did the phone company get back to you?" Wild asked. He was talking about Naomi's phone. "They're monitoring it. So far, no activity." "Meaning the phone is off?" "Yes." "Can they tell you when and where it was powered off?" "I'll check." "Did you talk to Matthew last night?"
"Yeah."
"And?"
"And it might be better if you talk to him directly." Wild didn't want to betray Matthew's trust. Hester understood.
"There is one other thing you can do for me," Wild said. "I'm not much in the mood to put a lot of resources on this. I mean, unless you have some real evidence Naomi didn't just run away."
"Fair enough," Wild said. "Can you make one more call to Naomi's mother?" He briefly filled her in on his conversation with Ava O'Brien, the art teacher.
"So, if the mother took the kid, wouldn't she tell the father?" Hester asked.
"Who knows? A quick call to the mom might put it to rest. If you're too busy."
"What, you're gonna call? What would you say? Hi, I'm a single male in my late 30s looking for your daughter?"
"Good point.
I'll do it."
"You okay, Hester?"
She was staring at a photograph of Cheryl Carmichael in a one-piece that could be a cover shot for the Sports Illustrated swimsuit issue. "I'm average at best."
"You sound grouchier than usual."
"Maybe," she said. "Where are you?"
"Still at the high school. I want to try to question the Maynard kid."
Wild hung up the call with Hester and turned to Ava.
"You sure about this?"
"Yes."
"It might blow back on you."
Ava shrugged. "I'm out at the end of the year anyway. All the part-timers are. Budget cuts."
"Sorry."
She waved it away. "It's time I moved back to Maine anyway."
They'd stayed in the same art room. Wild had slowly circled, checking out the various student works throughout the room. It was, in some way, the greatest museum he'd ever seen. There were drawings and watercolors and sculptures and mobiles and pottery and jewelry, and while the talent level was naturally all over the place, the heart and creativity were never less than mesmerizing. They stood by the door and waited for the final bell.
"This wasn't an art room when I was here," he said.
"What was it?"
"Shop with Mr. Cece."
She smiled. "Did you make a lamp or footstool?"
"Lamp."
"Where is it now?"
He had given it to the Brewers, his foster-come-adoptive parents, who retired to a gated community in Jupiter, Florida. Wild and his foster sister, Rola, had helped the Brewers move in 8 years ago, renting a U-Haul for the long drive down Interstate 95.
Rolla kept wanting to stop at roadside oddities along the way, like the UFO Welcome Center in South Carolina and America's smallest church in Georgia. Wild hadn't been back to Florida since. When the bell trilled, Wild slipped into a supply closet. Ava stood near the door to the corridor. 2 minutes later, Crash Maynard came in.
"You wanted to see me, Miss O'Brien?"
Wild left the closet door open a crack so he could watch. Ava said, "Yes, thank you." Crash touched a clay sculpture standing by the stool.
"That's still drying," Ava warned him. "I don't get why you paged me. I haven't taken an art class since freshman year."
"This isn't about art. Why don't you have a seat?"
"My mom's waiting for me, so do you know where Naomi Pine is?"
Wild liked that. No reason to play around.
"Me?"
Crash said it as though the very notion that he might know was the most shocking and incomprehensible concept ever uttered.
"Why would I know?"
"You and Naomi are classmates."
"Yeah, but..."
"But?" Crash gave a chuckle that seemed both nervous and cocky at the same time.
"We aren't exactly friends or anything."
"But you talk."
"No, we don't."
Ava folded her arms.
"Why should she tell me that you did?"
"Naomi said that?"
"Yes."
Crash gave it a second. You could see the wheels turning as an aw shucks smile spread across his face.
"I shouldn't say this, but I think Naomi might have a thing for me."
"And if she did?"
"Well, I mean, if she said we talked."
Shrug.
"I don't know, maybe she was trying to show off or something."
"Show off?"
"Yeah, or, I don't know, I'm nice to her and all, so, like, if she says hi to me, I say hi back."
"Wow," Ava said. "That is nice." The sarcasm went right over his head.
"But really, we don't have any serious interaction, you know what I mean?"
"I think I do," Ava said.
"Now, tell me about the night Matthew ghosted her, or whatever you call it at your house."
Silence.
"Crash?"
He lifted his phone into view and touched a button. Wild didn't like that.
"My mom is texting me, Ms. O'Brien."
"Okay.
I have to go."
"Answer my question first."
"Yeah, I don't know what you're talking about."
"Yes, you do. Naomi told me."
"She told you?"
"Yes."
"Then there's no reason to ask me about it," Crash said, which, Wild had to admit, was a pretty decent rejoinder. "I'd better leave now, Ms. O'Brien." "I want to know," Crash spun toward her, getting a little too close.
"I don't know anything about Naomi Pine."
The aw shucks tone was gone.
"Nothing."
Ava didn't back away.
"You saw her that night."
"So what if I did? She was on my property."
"Why did you tell Matthew Krimstein to prank her?"
"Did Matthew tell you that?"
He shook his head.
"Look, I'm allowed to leave, right? You can't force me to stay, can you?"
"No, of course not."
"Then I'm out of here."
Wild figured, why not? He opened the closet door and said, "I can stop you." He crossed the room and positioned himself so that his back was against the door, literally blocking the teen's exit. Ava shot him a look and shook her head. The look and head shake both said that this wasn't the way to handle it. Crash scowled.
What is this?"
"Tell us where Naomi is," Wild said. His eyes narrowed.
"You came to my house the other night. You're the one who grabbed the gun from my guard."
Ava shot Wild another look. He ignored it.
"You're not in trouble," Wild said,
which may or may not have been true. "We just need to find Naomi." The door behind Wild suddenly burst open, hitting him in the back and throwing him off balance.
Thor surged through the door, lowering his shoulder like a blitzing linebacker. Wild cursed himself. Of course the kid would have security. Of course he'd use his phone to signal he needed help. Stupid of Wild to be caught off guard. Now he was in serious trouble. Thor leapt toward Wild, no hesitancy. Wild was still trying to get his bearings, but it was too late. Thor wrapped his muscled arms around Wild, his shoulder in the midsection, and drove Wild back, squeezing and lifting Wild right off the ground. Thor kept his legs going, ready to slam Wild into the floor. This was definitely not good. Thor was mad, probably upset about being embarrassed when Wild disarmed him in front of his boss. This
was payback. Wilde debated his next move. There really wasn't one. He was off his feet in a bear hug with milliseconds before he hit the floor. If they were standing or slowed down, he might try to headbutt the big man's nose, but Thor had lowered his face into Wilde's chest. That wouldn't work. Nothing would. He would have to brace for the blow and recover, plan the next move. At the last possible moment, Wilde twisted his body hard. It didn't stop him from getting slammed to the ground, not at all. He got slammed on the formica, slammed hard. The air whooshed out of him. But by twisting his body, Wilde had wrenched Thor's grip enough so that instead of Thor's arm landing on the meaty flesh beneath the forearm, his elbow took the brunt of the fall. That hurt, too. One man had a hurt elbow, but the other man, Wilde, couldn't breathe. Distance, Wilde thought. That was his only thought, distance. Get away from his attacker. Put as much space as possible between himself and Thor. Regroup, recover. Still on the floor, Wilde tried to ignore the desire, nay, the absolute need to breathe. That was the thing. He'd had the wind knocked out of him before. It was paralyzing and awful, but what he'd learned with experience was that paralysis was mostly caused by fear. You feel as though you'll suffocate, that you'll never breathe again. That shut down everything. Orders from the brain to the feet or legs were cut off. But Wilde now knew, despite all his primitive instincts telling him otherwise, that his breath would eventually return, faster if he didn't panic. And so he fought through the temptation to just stay where he was and curl up into a ball until he could recover his breath. With his lungs bursting, Wilde log-rolled away. "Get off him!" Ava shouted. But Thor was relentless. He dove on top of him, driving his knees into the small of Wilde's back. The jolt sent what felt like shards of glass up his spine. Ava tried to pull Thor away, but he shrugged her off like so little dandruff. Wilde tried to spin to help, but Thor was having none of it. He snaked his arm under Wilde's, and the grappling began in earnest. When you look at old movies or training films, it was all about the strikes. Men stood and threw punches, sometimes kicks. The majority of fights, however, ended up on the ground, grappling matches. Thor would have the size and weight advantage. He'd have the element of surprise. He'd have the fact that Wilde was still trying to catch his breath. The key to victory often involved sacrifice. Wilde watched enough football to know that the quarterbacks who stood in the pocket, who didn't wince even when a 300-pound lineman was about to demolish them like a freight train, those were the ones who succeeded. The greats took the hit, while never losing focus on their target. That was what Wilde did right now. He let the bigger man land a few blows, because he had one target, a finger. He shifted, knowing that Thor would have to grab him near his shoulder to keep him in place. He waited for that. He concentrated on that, Thor's hand heading for his shoulder, and only that. And when Thor reached for him, Wilde let go with both hands, grabbed one of Thor's fingers, and bent it back with everything he had. The finger broke with an audible snap. Thor howled. Distance, Wilde thought. He rolled away again. He could see the toxic mix of rage and pain in Thor's face. The big man prepared to launch himself again. But a voice cut through the air like a reaper's scythe. "That's enough!" It was Gavin Chambers. Chapter 19. Once in the school parking lot, Gavin Chambers packed Thor, who was cradling his broken finger as though it were a wounded pet, into a black Cadillac Escalade and sent him on his way. He put a sheepish crash into a white Mercedes-Benz S-Class coupe driven by Crash's mother. The mother, Wilde knew that her name was Delia, was having none of it. She got out of the car and demanded an explanation from Gavin. Wilde stood too far away to hear what was being said, but he was still close enough to get pierced by the occasional maternal eye dagger. Kids from the school had gathered. Wilde recognized Kyle and Ryan and Sutton and a few of the other kids Matthew had told him about over the years. Matthew was there, too, looking properly mortified. He met Wilde's eye as if to say, "What gives?" Wilde gave him nothing in return. Eventually, Delia Maynard got back into her car, slammed the door, and drove away with Crash in the passenger seat. The onlookers, including Matthew, dispersed. Gavin Chambers made his way back over to Wilde and said, "Let's take a walk." They strolled between a fence and the building's brick back. Wilde could see the football field, and, more relevant to his past, the quarter-mile track that encircled it. That was the spot of his purported glory days, though no waves of nostalgia washed over him. He didn't suddenly see himself as a sprinting teen or anything like that. You move forward in life. You may give the old you a nod every once in a while, but the old you is gone and not coming back. That was often a good thing.
"I thought the girl was found," Gavin said.
"She's gone again.
You mind telling me about it?"
"Yeah, I do." Gavin shook his head.
"What you did here, confronting the kid like that, injuring my man, it makes me look bad."
He stopped. "I thought we had an understanding." "That was before Naomi vanished again."
"And you have evidence that Crash is involved?"
Wilde didn't say anything.
Gavin put his hand to his ear. "I can't hear you."
"It was why I was asking him questions."
"I think you went a little too far, don't you? His mother is furious. She wants to report the art teacher."
"It's on me, not her."
"Noble of you. But I'm not sure the school board will agree."
"Threatening the school teacher's job," Wilde said with a small shake of the head. "That's kind of beneath you, isn't it?" Gavin smiled.
"It is, yes. I read up on you, Wilde. Most of your military record is classified, but..."
"Well, I'm not without means."
"Very impressive. Your whole life story is.
But as I said before, I have the manpower and resources. So here is our new deal. I'll question the kid for you. If Crash Maynard knows anything about this girl, I'll tell you." They kept walking.
"I have a question," Wilde said.
"I'm listening."
"Last time we talked, you said there was much more at stake here than a teenage brawl."
"Is that a question?"
"What's at stake?"
"You don't want to know."
"Seriously?"
Gavin Chambers smiled.
"It has nothing to do with Naomi Pine."
"Does it have something to do with Rusty Eggers?"
Another black Cadillac Escalade pulled in front of them.
Gavin slapped him on the back and moved toward it.
"Stay in touch," he said to Wilde. "But stay away."
When Wilde entered the woods on his way back to the eco-capsule, Matthew was waiting for him, pacing, his hands in tight fists.
"What the hell was that all about?"
"You seem upset," Wilde said. Wilde headed up the path. Matthew fell in behind him.
"Well?"
"Well what?"
"What were you doing at my school?"
"I asked Crash Maynard about Naomi."
"At my school? Are you kidding me?"
"That a problem, Matthew?"
"I have to go to school here. You get that right?"
Wilde stopped.
"What?"
Matthew asked.
"Did you already forget what you did to her?"
That shut the boy up. Wilde watched the blood drain from Matthew's face. The woods stood silent, solemn. Matthew's voice, when he found it, was soft.
"No."
His chin was down, and, ah, damn, just like David. The echo of the father was so strong on the son's face right now that Wilde almost took a step back. A few seconds later, Matthew's chin rose. He saw the expression on Wilde's face and snapped, "Cut that out!"
"I'm not doing anything."
"Yeah, you are,"
Matthew said.
"You know, I hate when you give me that, oh my God, he looks like his dad face."
Wilde couldn't help but smile.
"Fair enough.
Just stop it."
"Okay, I'm sorry."
Wilde mimed, wiping away the expression on his face with his hand.
"See?"
Matthew sighed.
"You can be so lame."
Wilde smiled.
"What?"
"That's the kind of thing your father would have said."
Matthew rolled his eyes.
"Will you stop?"
He often warned Matthew that he would bring up his father, like it or not. He didn't do it to appease David's ghost or any of that. Dead was dead in Wilde's worldview. But for Matthew, he'd been robbed of his father. It doesn't mean he should be robbed of the memory or influence.
"So what would Saint Dad say about this?" Matthew asked in the most grudging tone he could muster.
"About what?"
"About what I did to Naomi."
"He'd be pissed."
"Would he ground me?"
"Oh, yeah.
He would also make you apologize."
I tried to.
Then,
I will.
Cool.
And your dad wasn't a saint. He messed up plenty. But he also made amends.
They were heading across the ravine, not far from the eco-capsule, when Matthew said,
Always?
Always what?
Did he always make amends?
Wilde felt something flutter inside his chest.
He tried.
Mom thinks you're hiding something about the night of the accident.
Wilde didn't break stride, but the word stung.
She told you that?
Are you?
No. Matthew eyed him. Forget David. The kid was more like Layla when he gave him the skeptical eye. Then Matthew blinked and said,
Doesn't matter, does it? He's dead either way.
Wilde thought about it and decided that his comment didn't require a response. Matthew asked,
So what did crash tell you?
The subject change plus the alternate definition of the word, crash, the name as opposed to crash as in the accident, threw him for a moment.
Not much, but he seemed nervous.
So you think, what, that crash did something to Naomi?
All signs still indicate she ran off on her own.
But?
But something isn't adding up for me.
Matthew smiled at that.
Didn't you teach me that there is always chaos?
Anomalies are to be expected, but there is still a certain pattern to the chaos.
A pattern to the chaos,
Matthew repeated.
That doesn't make much sense.
True enough, Wilde thought.
I think,
Matthew stammered,
I think what I did to Naomi that night, not showing up, I feel guilty, I guess. This is all my fault in some ways, right?
Matthew waited. Wilde waited. Then Wilde said, You want me to say something comforting here?
Only if you feel it.
I don't. They arrived at the eco-capsule. Matthew, the only guest he ever had out here, liked to do homework in the tighter confines. Fewer distractions, he told Wilde. Matthew wanted to study for a physics test. The kid was good in the sciences. Wilde stayed outside and read his book. 2 hours later, Matthew emerged.
Good study, Sesh? Wilde asked.
Yes, thank you. And never say Sesh again. They made the trek back toward Matthew's house. When they arrived, Wilde said he wanted some water. Normally, he'd leave once he made sure Matthew was inside, but what with the strangeness around Naomi and even Crash, it might pay to hang around until his mother got home. He also wanted to see Layla for two reasons. The first was what Matthew had just told him, that Layla still questioned the official account of what happened on that treacherous mountain road all those years ago.
Matthew?
Yeah? Wilde thought back to Ava's conversation with Crash.
Anything you're keeping from me?
Huh?
About Naomi?
No. Matthew handed him the glass of water. Then he headed up to his bedroom and closed the door. He didn't tell Wilde what he was up to, and Wilde didn't ask. Wilde sat in the den and waited. At 7 p.m., Layla's car glided into the driveway. He stood when she opened the door.
Hey,
Layla said when she saw him.
Hey.
I've been meaning to talk to you, Layla said. This was the second and more important reason Wilde had stayed.
Yeah, I know, Wilde said.
Layla stopped. You know? I was here the other night with Matthew when you pulled up. I ducked out the back.
Oh, Layla said.
Yeah.
Early days, Layla said. I don't know if it'll go anywhere.
You don't need to explain.
But it might. Layla just looked at him. He got the message. She was ready to take the relationship with Designer Threads to the next level. The physical level, for those slow on the take.
No worries, Wilde said.
Plenty of worries, Layla countered.
I know what you mean, Wilde.
He nodded and stood.
I better go.
It won't be weird, right?
It never is it?
Sometimes it is, yeah, Layla said. And sometimes you stay away too much.
I don't want to intrude.
You won't intrude.
But Matthew still needs you.
I still need you.
He crossed the room and kissed her cheek with almost too much tenderness. I'll be here when you need me. I love you, Wild. I love you too, Layla. He smiled. She smiled. Wild felt something in his chest crack a little. Layla, well, he didn't know what she felt. Good night, he said, and left by the back door. Chapter 20. Hester chose the restaurant, Red Farm, a modern dim sum joint that mixes delicious with casual and a touch of food humor. Her favorite dumplings, for example, were called Pac-Man and looked like the ghostly creatures from the old video game. Red Farm didn't take reservations, but Hester came often, and so she knew a guy who could get her a corner table when she needed it. The vibe here was creative and cool, rather than romantic and quiet, but hey, first date. No pressure, right? Oren had trusted Hester to order. Now, the table was loaded up with dumplings. Three-color vegetable, shrimp and mango, pork and crab soup, another favorite, crispy oxtail, black truffle chicken. Heaven, Oren muttered between bites. You like? So delicious. I'm almost forgetting how wonderful the company is. Smooth line, Hester said.
Can I ask you about your ex-wife?
His chopsticks had just clamped down on a dumpling.
Seriously?
I'm not good with subtlety. Nice demonstration of that.
And it's on my mind.
My ex-wife is on your mind?
I just have a few questions.
I can sit here and let them distract me, or I can just ask them.
Oren picked up the dim sum. I don't want you distracted.
I found Cheryl's Instagram page.
Ah, he said.
You've seen it.
I haven't. No, I don't do social media.
But you know about it.
I do, yes.
Do you still think about her?
I'm supposed to answer no, right?
I saw the pics.
Uh-huh.
So I don't blame you.
Of course I still think about her, but not like that. We were married for 28 years. Do you still think of Ira?
Hester didn't answer right away.
She had tried on a dozen outfits before settling on this dress. It was only as she caught her reflection in a window on the street that she realized it was a dress Ira always said made her look sexy.
We both have pasts, Hester.
She wasn't sure how to put it. We're so different, Cheryl and I.
Yes.
I know this is only a first date, but she's just so sexy.
So are you. Don't patronize me, Oren.
I'm not.
I get it. But this isn't a competition.
Thank God for that.
You said Cheryl left you.
She did. And she didn't.
Meaning?
I think I left her first, at least emotionally. She left me because, in part, I left her.
He put down his chopsticks and wiped his chin with his napkin. His movements were deliberate now.
When the kids were gone, I think Cheryl felt adrift. You know our town. It's about raising families. When that's gone, well, you, Hester, have a career. But Cheryl just looked around her. And the kids are gone, and I'm still going to work every day, and she's either at home or playing tennis or going to Zumba or whatever.
So she just ended it?
One of us doesn't have to be at fault. Divorce doesn't mean your marriage was a failure.
Sorry to disagree, but divorce seems to be pretty much the definition of a failed marriage.
Oren clenched his jaw and turned away for a moment. Cheryl and I had 28 years together. We raised 3 good kids. We have a grandchild and another on the way. Put it this way, if you owned a car for 28 years and then it breaks down, does that make the car a failure?
Hester frowned. That analogy is a stretch.
Then how about this one? If life is a book, we are both starting new chapters. She'll always be important to me. I'll always wish her happiness.
She's just, to continue with this analogy, not in your chapters anymore?
Exactly.
Hester shook her head. God, that's so mature, I want to barf.
Oren smiled. Not until I try that crispy oxtail dim sum, please.
Okay, one final question, Hester said.
Fine, go ahead.
Hester cupped her hands in front of her chest. Cheryl had a boob job, right? I mean, those puppies are high enough to double as earrings.
Oren laughed as Hester felt her phone vibrate. She counted the pulses in her head.
3 pulses, she said. I have to take it.
What?
1 pulse is just a regular call. 2 pulses means it's work. 3, it's something important and I should pick it up.
Oren gestured with both hands. Pick it up already.
She put the phone to her ear. It was Sarah McClin from her office.
What's up?
Hester asked. Are you on your date?
You're interrupting it.
Sneak a photo of him. I want to see.
Was there another reason for this call?
Does there have to be?
Sarah.
Fine. I reached out to Naomi's mother like you asked.
And?
And she refuses to talk to you. She said to mind your own business and hung up.
Gavin Chambers was at the window of his office high-rise in Midtown, looking down at the protesters, a ragtag group of aging grunge-ola that probably numbered no more than 20, mulling inside the building's courtyard. The chant, "Release the tapes!" was hardly catching fire. The quasi-vagrants held up signs for every left-wing cause. 2 of the women donned faded pink knit caps. According to the various signs, they wanted to free Palestine, resist, abolish ICE, but their hearts didn't seem to be in it today. The march looked to Gavin more like a languid sway. Delia joined him at the window.
Isn't that...
Saul Strauss, Gavin said with a nod. His old war buddy wasn't hard to spot, Saul being close to 6'6" and sporting the long gray ponytail that was so on point it could only be there to be on point. Dash finished up a phone call and moved next to his wife. There was an ease between Dash and Delia, always a flow, and while Gavin had had plenty of great relationships in his life, he envied these two. People can fool you. They fool you every day. But Gavin had been hanging around the Maynards long enough to recognize that Dash and Delia were the real deal, the kind of love that makes yours, no matter how good, seem somewhat inadequate. It wasn't just what they said. It wasn't just how they looked at each other or casually touched. There was an intangible here, that mix of great friendship and physical attraction, and maybe that was something Gavin was projecting on them. But when they talk about a soulmate, one person in this world that is perfect for you and almost impossible to find, Dash and Delia seem to have done just that.
What do the protesters want? Delia asked.
You can hear them, Gavin said. They want the tapes.
There are no tapes, Delia replied.
They don't believe that.
Do you, Gavin? She asked.
Doesn't matter.
That's not an answer.
I'll protect you either way.
Dash finally spoke. That's not what she asked. Gavin looked at Dash, then back at Delia.
Of course there are tapes, Gavin said. Are they as damaging to Rusty as our hemp-adorned friends below would like to believe? Not for me to say.
Dash moved back toward his office desk. You understand the situation, then? Gavin didn't bother with a response.
We aren't safe, Delia said, moving with her husband. If Crash could be approached like that in his very school,
that won't happen again.
Dash put his arm around his wife's shoulder. Again, Gavin couldn't help but notice the ease, the naturalness, the tenderness in this everyday move.
Not good enough.
Who was that man? Delia asked.
Crash didn't tell you?
Delia shook her head.
He said he kept asking about Naomi Pine.
They call him Wild.
Wait, he's that weird mountain guy they found in the woods?
Yes.
Well, I don't get it. What does he have to do with Naomi Pine?
He is something of a surrogate parent for Matthew Krimstein. For some reason, Matthew and his family are interested in Naomi's whereabouts.
Krimstein, Dash repeated. As in Hester?
Yes. No one liked that.
Crash swears he doesn't know anything about Naomi, Delia said. When Gavin didn't respond, she asked, Do you think he does?
Crash has been in touch with her, Naomi Pine, I mean. As you probably know, she disappeared a week or so ago playing a game called Challenge.
Some of the mothers were talking about that.
Crash encouraged her to do it.
Are you saying he forced her?
No. but peer pressure was a major factor.
You don't think Crash did something bad to this girl, do you?
Very doubtful, Gavin said. He's too monitored. They both were visibly relieved. But that doesn't mean he knows nothing about it.
So what do we do? I don't like this. Delia looked down at the courtyard again. Saul Strauss was staring straight up, almost as though he could see them through the one-way windows. I don't like any of this.
I would suggest the family take a bit of a break from this town, maybe travel overseas.
Why?
People perceive Rusty Eggers as an existential threat.
Gavin Chambers waited for one of them to argue this point. Neither did. Delia said, Gavin?
Yes.
We are safe, right? You won't let anything happen to our son.
You're safe, Gavin said. He's safe.
Chapter 21 Matthew made himself a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, sat alone at the kitchen table, ate it, still felt hungry, made a second, and was eating when there was a knock on his back door. He looked out the window and was surprised, closer to shocked, to see Crash Maynard. Prepared for anything, Matthew carefully opened the door halfway.
Hey,
Crash said.
Hey? Can I come in a second?
Matthew didn't move or open the door any wider.
What's up?
I just... Crash used his sleeve to wipe his eyes. He looked out at the yard.
Remember when we used to play kickball out here?
In fifth grade.
We sat next to each other in Mr. Richardson's class,
Crash said. He was out there, wasn't he?
Yeah. But he was also kind of awesome.
He was, Matthew agreed.
We were tight then, remember?
Yeah, Matthew said, I guess.
It was easier.
What was?
Everything. No one really cared about who had the big house or what other people thought. We just cared about kickball.
Matthew knew this wasn't exactly true. It may have been a more innocent time, but it wasn't that innocent.
What do you want, Crash?
To say I'm sorry?
Tears streamed down his cheeks. His voice was more a sob now.
I'm so damn sorry.
Matthew stepped back. Why don't you come in?
But Crash didn't move.
There's so much shit going down around my house right now. I know that's no excuse, but it's like I'm living on top of a volcano and I'm waiting for it to erupt.
Gone was the high school hallway confidence, the swagger, the sneer. Matthew wasn't sure what to make of this, but something felt very wrong.
Come on in, he tried again. We used to drink Yoo-Hoo, right? I think my mom still has some in the fridge.
Crash shook his head.
I can't. They'll be looking for me.
Who?
I just wanted you to know. Okay, I'm really sorry I hurt you. And Naomi.
What I did.
Crash, just come in.
But Crash was already running away.
Wilde didn't feel like going back to his eco-capsule yet. His regular hangout, as much as one could say he had such a thing, was a bar located in the atrium lobby of the glass-towered Sheraton Hotel on Route 17 in Mahwah, New Jersey. The hotel advertised itself as unfussy yet upscale, which seemed pretty close to the truth. This was a hotel for business people, here for one night, maybe two, and that worked for both the guests and Wilde. The Sheraton's bar had a nice open feel, being in a glass atrium. The bartenders, like Nicole McChrystal, who gave him a welcoming smile as he entered, stayed the same, while the clientele, mostly young executives blowing off a little steam, constantly changed. Wilde liked hotel bars for that latter reason, the transient nature, the openness, the rooms and beds being conveniently located only an elevator ride away, should they be needed.
Was it too soon?
Probably. But how long should Wilde give it? A week? 2 weeks? The wait seemed arbitrary and unnecessary. He wasn't heartbroken. Neither was Layla. It was what it was.
Wild! Nicole called out, clearly happy to see him. She brought him a beer. When it came to beer, he was, like the hotel, unfussy, but he enjoyed whatever local ale was on tap. Today, that was a blonde lager from the Asbury Park Brewery. Nicole leaned over the bar to buss his cheek. Tom, down at the other end, gave him a wave. "Been a while," she said to him. Nicole smiled. She had a kind smile.
"Yeah. Back on the prowl?"
He didn't reply to that one because he didn't yet know the answer. She leaned toward him. "A few past conquests were asking about you."
"Don't call them that.
What name would you prefer?"
A guy bellied up to the other end of the bar and raised his hand. Nicole said, "Think it over, and I'll be back later."
Wild took a deep sip from his mug and listened to the hum of the hotel. His phone buzzed. It was Hester.
"Wild!"
He could barely hear her over the background noise on her end.
"Where are you?"
he asked.
"At a restaurant."
"I see."
"I'm on a date."
"I see."
"With Orrin Carmichael."
"I see."
"You're a great conversationalist, Wild. Such enthusiasm."
"Do you want me to yell yippee?"
"Naomi's mother won't talk to me."
"What do you mean by that?"
"What do you think I mean?" "I mean she won't talk to me. She refuses to return my calls. She says her daughter is none of my business."
"So Naomi is with her?"
"I don't know. I was going to send my investigator over to her house, but get this. She's vacationing in the south of Spain."
"So maybe Naomi is traveling with her. Maybe Naomi needed to escape all the bullying, so her mother took her to Spain."
"Where are you, Wild?"
"I'm at the Sheraton bar."
"Careful,"
Hester said.
"You hold your liquor like an 18-year-old co-ed at her first mixer."
"What's a mixer?"
"You're too young to know."
"For that matter, what's a co-ed?"
"Funny. Let's talk in the morning. I have to get back to Orrin."
"You're on a date," Wild said. Then,
"Yippee! Wise ass."
At some point, Wild found himself talking to Sandra, a redhead in her early 30s with tight slacks and an easy laugh. They sat at the quiet end of the bar. She'd been born in Morocco, where her father had been working for the embassy. He was CIA, she told him. Pretty much all embassy employees are spies, not just the USA ones. All over. I mean, think about it. You get to bring in whoever you want to a protected location in the heart of a foreign country. Of course, you're going to send your best counterintelligence people, right? Sandra had moved around a lot as a kid, embassy to embassy, mostly in Africa and the Middle East. "My hair fascinated them. There are so many superstitions surrounding redheads." She'd gone to UCLA and loved it and got a degree in hotel management. She was divorced and had one son, age 6, at home. "I don't travel much, but I do this trip every year." Her son was staying with his dad. She and her ex got along. She liked staying at this Sheraton. They always upgraded her room to the presidential suite. "You have to see it," she said in a tone that could knock a movie rating from PG to R. "Top floor. You can see the skyline of New York from it. It's 3 rooms, so, like, if we just wanted to have a drink in the living room space, I mean, I don't want you to think." Eventually, Sandra gave him a key card. "They gave me 2 when I came in," Sandra quickly explained. "One for the living room, one for the bedroom. You know what I mean?" Wild, still nursing his second blonde lager, assured her that he did. "Anyway, I can't sleep yet with the time change. I'm going to do some work in the living room if you want to come up later and have a nightcap." Nightcap. Mixer. Co-ed. It was like he was living in 1963. He thanked Sandra but promised nothing. She headed to the elevator. He stared at the key card so as not to stare at her. "A drink," she'd said. In the living room, not the bedroom. Maybe that was all it was. Maybe it was nothing more than that. Then a tall man with a ponytail asked, "Are you gonna go up?" The tall man grabbed the stool right next to him, despite the fact that there had to be 20 open ones.
"She's very attractive," the tall man said. "I like redheads.
Don't you?
Wilde said nothing. The tall man stuck out his hand. My name is Saul, he said.
Strauss, Wilde added.
You know who I am.
Wilde didn't reply.
Well, I'm flattered.
Wilde had seen Strauss on Hester's show every once in a while. He was a good talking head, an endearing mix of that super-progressive college professor with the cred of being a bona fide war hero. Wilde was not a fan of pundits. They came on television to either confirm your narrative or piss you off, and either way, that wasn't healthy for anyone.
I didn't catch your name, Strauss said.
But you know it.
Does anyone?
He gave Wilde an inquisitive look that must wow the college, to use Hester's vernacular, co-eds.
They call you Wilde, right? You're the infamous boy from the woods.
Wilde pulled out the necessary bills from his wallet and dropped them on the bar. It was nice meeting you, he said, rising. Strauss was unruffled.
So, you going up to a room?
Seriously?
Well, I don't mean to pry.
Hey, Saul. Can I call you Saul?
Sure.
Why don't we skip the rest of the foreplay and get to it?
Is that your plan when you go upstairs?
Strauss quickly raised a palm.
Sorry.
That was going too far. Wilde started to walk away. Strauss said,
I hear you had a run-in with the Maynard kid today.
Wilde turned back to him.
You asked me to skip the foreplay, right? Strauss said.
Heard from whom?
I have my sources,
and they are
anonymous.
By then, Strauss put his hand on Wilde's forearm. His grip was surprisingly strong.
It could be important.
Wilde hesitated, but then he sat back down. He was curious. Strauss was a partisan, who wasn't nowadays, but he'd also hit Wilde as something of a straight shooter. Instinctively, Wilde had thought that the best move was to simply blow the man off, but with a little more time to reason, he started to wonder what he had to lose by listening here. Not a thing. Wilde said, I'm looking for a teenage girl who probably ran away.
Naomi Pine.
Wilde shouldn't have been surprised.
Your sources are good. You're not the only one out here who is ex-military. What does Crash Maynard have to do with Naomi Pine?
Strauss was all business now. Maybe nothing.
But?
She's an outcast. He's Mr. Popular. Yep, there's been some interaction.
Could you be more specific?
Strauss asked. Why don't you ask your source?
Do you know anything about the Maynard's relationship with Rusty Eggers?
I know that Maynard was his producer.
Dash Maynard created Eggers.
Okay.
Strauss leaned in closer. Do you realize how dangerous Eggers is?
Wilde saw no reason to answer that one.
Do you?
Strauss insisted.
Let's say I do.
And you've heard about the Maynard tapes.
I don't see the connection, Wilde said.
There may not be one. Wilde, can I ask you a favor? Not a favor, really. You're a patriot. You want those tapes released, I'm sure.
You don't know what I want.
I know you want the truth. I know you want justice.
And I don't know that you bring either of those things.
Truth is an absolute.
Or it used to be.
The Maynard tapes should be released because the people should know the truth about Rusty Eggers. Who can argue with that? If the people see the truth, the full truth, and still want to hand the keys to the country to this nihilist, okay, that's one thing.
Saul?
Yes?
Get to the point.
Just keep me informed, and I'll keep you informed.
It's your best bet for finding that girl.
You served admirably because you love this country.
But Eggers is a threat like none this country has faced before. He's hoodwinking this nation with his charisma, but his supposed manifesto is really a call for anarchy. It'll lead to food shortages, worldwide panic, constitutional crises, and even war.
Saul slid a little closer and lowered his voice.
Suppose the Maynard tapes show the real Rusty Eggers. Suppose they open people's eyes to the grave dangers right in front of them. This is bigger than any mission we undertook overseas, Wilde. You have to believe me on that.
He handed Wild a card with his mobile phone and email. Then he slapped him on the back and walked past the reception desk toward the door. Wild pocketed Saul Strauss's business card and stood. He meandered toward the lobby bathroom, urinated for a fairly long time. Then, to quote, paraphrase Springsteen, he checked his look in the mirror and wanted to change his clothes, his hair, his face. He splashed water on his cheeks and tidied himself up as best he could. He walked to the glass elevator and pressed the up button. Nicole, the bartender, caught his eye and gave a small nod. He didn't know how to read it or if it meant anything at all, so he gave her a small nod back. To get to the top floor, you needed to slide a key card into the slot. He did that with the card Sandra had given him. He rode up, leaning against the glass, looking down as the lobby grew smaller and smaller. Faces swirled through his mind's eye. Matthew, Naomi, Crash, Gavin, Saul,